through it. May it please the court, 15 U.S.C. section 1681 uses different formulations of the term and word use. In one section, it's unmodified. In another section, it's modified by the phrase directly or indirectly. And yet, according to the Federal Trade Commission, those things mean the same thing.
And elsewhere in the statute, it talks about use or obtain, doesn't it? I mean,
use or obtain is in Section E, Your Honor.
Same statute.
Same provision. Obtains or uses directly or indirectly.
And that's important, isn't it? I mean, we're supposed to look to context. We don't just rely on dictionaries. We look to context of the statute, right?
That is correct, Your Honor. And basic statutory formulation would say that if the word is unmodified, it has its common ordinary meaning. And if it's used in a different formulation, it's used differently. Congress had three bites at the apple on definitions here, Your Honor. In 2003, when the FACT Act added 1681 MH on risk-based pricing, it used the term use. No modification, common ordinary meaning. In July of 2010, when the Dodd-Frank Act amended this section, this very specific section, it added the requirement that the user disclose the credit score and other information. Kind of hard for a user to disclose something if they haven't seen it or known about it. They didn't amend the word use. They added credit score. And then in December of 2010, when the red flag section was amended, that's the E part, Your Honor, now they put in the word obtains or uses directly or indirectly. So they did two things. They didn't use the word use. They put a different phrase in, and they didn't go back and amend H. So they mean different things. I contend, Your Honor, and I think the statute is clear, that this is not ambiguous. H is not ambiguous in any event. The common ordinary term use, I don't think, can be stretched to mean it applies if you have never obtained it, never
Counsel,
seen it.
I have a problem with the regulation. Why isn't the regulation that the government put out, the FTC put out, isn't 2010, doesn't that answer the question? Literally, doesn't it make clear that the FTC's interpretation is that the dealer uses the credit information?
That's what they said, Your Honor.
Wait a minute, isn't that what the regulation says? Flatly, there's no question about it. It says the dealer uses.
It's not a regulation, it's a supplementary interpretation, but that's what it says.
No, wait a minute. I'm talking about the 2010, right? Isn't that a regulation?
The 2010 is there's a supplementary information and a regulation, but the 2010 one did not discuss this issue.
The judge is talking about section 640.6, part B, multi-party transaction.
Part B, that's about the initial user.
It says the person to whom a credit obligation is initially payable must provide the risk-based pricing notice. Right.
Yes,
and the dealer is always the person, that person, right?
Only if, in fact, you determine that they are the user.
The regulation specifically says that.
The regulation is an exemption.
And unfortunately for your case, you never challenged the regulation.
The regulation is an exemption from those who actually use it. It's an exemption from the finance companies.
No, wait a minute. That's a separate part.
No, that's B, 640.6B. Yeah. Is part of the exemption. That's where the exemption is found.
Well, but isn't it crystal clear that the FTC and the Fed, I guess, was involved, specifically said that you, the dealer, are a user?
No, I think it said that you are a user for the purposes of giving the disclosure if, in fact, you are a user under the statute. But I don't think that
Where did they say if, in fact, you are a user under the statute?
640.6B, Your Honor. Is part of that exemption provision where they have exempted the financing companies.
That is part of it too, but it specifically says you're the user. You didn't challenge it.
That is correct. We did not challenge that provision, Your Honor.
So why isn't that the end of the case?
Because the FTC is not relying upon 640.6B. They're relying upon their supplementary information in 2011.
They actually rely both on their regulation and the statute. But as I read it, and your concern about the manner in which they responded to your effort to, or your suggestion that some dealers were in a different position than other dealers, was to say in the preamble of a new regulation that they disagreed with you. Now, that preamble to a new regulation looks to me, as a matter of administrative law, to have been essentially an interpretive rule, an interpretation of their regulation.
I understand your position, Your Honor, but if you look at their brief at page 31, their FTC brief, they conceded that the 2010 rule was based on an assumption that auto dealers actually obtain consumer credit reports. That assumption was incorrect. That is wrong, and that's why their rule doesn't apply here, because it was based upon an incorrect assumption.
So then at the best you could say there was an ambiguity in the rule. That's the very best you could say, and therefore the preamble is an interpretation of that rule.
The preamble is an interpretation, and I submit to you, Your Honor, that the rule is based upon an incorrect assumption.
No. But it's an interpretation of the rule.
In that case, it doesn't suffice for either Chevron or Barnhart, because
then we look at Seminole Rock. It's an interpretation of the rule. They get a lot of deference on that too.
Not under this statute, Your Honor, and the reason is because of H. Section H, which is what this is about, begins with the proposition subject to the provisions of section 6, paragraph 6. And paragraph 6 is rulemaking. The only way that they can deal with this is not through supplementary interpretation, but through rules. And what they claim
Stop. That's not correctly a matter of administrative law. An agency has the authority to issue substantive rules. It did issue a substantive rule. The substantive rule in hoc verba sounds like it destroys your position. What you argue, wait a minute, it was based on an assumption that was incorrect because not all the dealers had access to the credit report. So you write a letter saying, you know, that your assumption is wrong. The agency responds. They did so in a preamble to a regulation, but they could have done it by letter. And that the agency responds that, no, our rule applies to all dealers. And I don't understand why we even get into the Chevron Mead question, because they're interpreting their regulation. And you never challenge the regulation.
That's correct, Your Honor. We never challenge the regulation. But if the statute is clear and the regulation is based upon a wrong assumption,
you can challenge it any time.
That's right. You can come back and challenge it. But we don't think we need to at this point because
you didn't challenge it. That's unfortunate.
We did not challenge it. We did not challenge 640.6, Your Honor.
Well, I can't understand how you get to where you get to without it.
Well, Your Honor, it seems to me that if the regulation is based upon a wrong assumption, and if, in fact, you are not a user under the ordinary term, that regulation cannot trump the statute itself.
Well, the agency didn't say it was the wrong assumption about a user. The agency said they didn't address this question of whether the finance agency or the dealer had the report. But they never said that they were wrong about the interpretation of the word user before. They've consistently had the same view about user. In fact, the letter you sent them challenged the staff's interpretation. Isn't that right?
That's correct.
So you were, as Judge Silverman suggests, you're challenging an interpretation of a rule. That was the purpose of your letter. The FTC told you, well, if you want to challenge the interpretation, the way to do that is to send it in to the rulemaking. You did that, and now they've clarified that their interpretation stands. So why I'm not following what your response to Judge Silverman is at that point then?
Twofold, Your Honor. In Freeman, the 9-zip opinion last year by the Supreme Court, the court said that if in fact you are sweeping in a consumer and a creditor in a prohibition that's aimed at creditors, that rationale, that reasoning, that definition, that interpretation, that regulation cannot stand. And here, under the causal-based transaction analysis, it sweeps in the consumer because the consumer, as the FTC concedes, begins this change by wanting to buy a car and, quote, submitting a loan application to the dealer. That's what they say. Having said that, that's part of the causal transaction. If, in fact, use means direct or indirect, causal transaction, and it sweeps in the consumer as well as the creditor, then Freeman says it can't survive.
The FTC is not sweeping in the consumer. You're saying that's a logical implication of what they're doing, but they're not doing that. The word use can have more than one meaning, and because it can have more than one meaning, they can cut it off at a extremely indirect point. I guess I'm not exactly following why you think that the word use can only have one meaning here.
I think it has two meanings, Your Honor. I think it has one meaning in H and a different meaning in E, but they want to combine and consolidate that into one meaning.
Well, it doesn't say direct use. It just says use.
And it doesn't say indirect use.
Correct. So we don't know what it means.
I disagree, Your Honor. With all due respect, the word use, unmodified in 2003 and 2010, was its common and ordinary meaning. And, in fact, when Congress went and amended E, they didn't use a common ordinary meaning. They used something more, obtains or uses, direct or indirect. If the word use was consistent throughout, we'd have a different case. But here in the same statutes, it's used in different formulations. And yet, under the FTC interpretation, it's one and the same. And might I ask for where I am on my time, please?
Your yellow light's not up yet.
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you.
Counsel, I get the impression you suggest that what's wrong here is that the FTC should have focused on the finance company as the user, not you. Not
correct.
The yep. But again, you didn't make that challenge to the regulation. The regulation quite clearly said they weren't going after the finance company, they're going after the dealer.
And that's part of their Chamber of Horrors approach here.
Oh, no, wait a minute. My concern is that you didn't make that challenge at the time the regulation came.
We did not challenge the regulation at the time.
But in you have footnotes that suggest, this is really wrong. They should be after the. Now, it's fair to say that if they're right under their interpretation of the statute, both the dealer and the finance company are users, right?
Under their interpretation, correct.
Right. But, and then you're suggesting there's a suggestion of an arbitrary and capricious challenge that it was unfair to go after the dealer rather than the finance company. Is that your challenge?
No, let me see if I can make it clear.
Here's my question. Assuming, arguendo, that user could apply to both, are you making now the challenge that it was unreasonable to go after the dealer, not the finance company?
No, that is not our challenge. It's arbitrary and capricious, but not unreasonable.
It's arbitrary and capricious, but not unreasonable. That's the same term.
Well, let me see if I can answer the question directly, Your Honor, and I apologize if I'm being unclear. The reason we had those footnotes in the brief was because what the FTC said is, without having the dealer do it, there would never be notice to the consumer of the risk-based pricing. You'd never get that information out. But the reason they don't get the information out is because they exempted the dealers under 640.6. If they want to include the true user, the one who pulls it, looks at it, and sees it, they can remove the exemption.
That's a fair point. You did make that point. I'm curious on the FTC. But their argument, I suppose, is, as their policy argument here, is that if we put the burden on the finance company, you would then have a situation where three or four different finance companies would all have the obligation to provide the consumer with the notice, because they all could have been asked for their quote.
That's part of their argument.
Is that correct, though?
I don't think that's correct, Your Honor. But in any event, even if that is correct, the statute mandates that users do it. And all users, there's no exemption from users. They created the exemption.
Wait a minute, then don't they have the right to create the exemption?
They have a right to create the exemption, but that's not what Congress said. And to the extent that they're saying...
Wait a minute, if they have the right, they have the right.
Congress,
I believe Congress specifically gave them the right.
Congress gave them the right to create the exemption. It didn't say that there should only be one notice. Okay? And that's where they went. Your Honor, the argument that they have here is that this furthers the purpose of the statute. And when the Supreme Court decided the Dimension Financial case more than a quarter of a century ago, they said the purpose of the statute must not be used if the plain language of the statute itself controls. And we submit that the word use in H is different than the word obtains or uses directly or indirectly, and yet they're consolidated.
You're saying that the word use has some ordinary and everyday meaning.
Yes, sir.
And that it's not this one because somebody else actually used it.
Yes.
So if I invite Judge Silberman over to dinner and he says, what color paint did you use on the wall of your dining room? And I say, I don't know, I'm colorblind, ecru, I think. But in fact, I did not paint my dining room, by the way. A painter painted my dining room. Would I be using it in an inappropriate way or a not normal way? Would I have should I have said, well, I didn't use any color. My painter used the color.
I think you're using the term use in terms of a physicality correctly, but we're not talking about use of a physicality. We're talking about knowledge of the contents of a document. And if you ask whether somebody has used a document, they either have to have seen it, possessed it, or know of its contents. And I think it's very hard to stretch the word use in any other context.
If you were less of a exacting lawyer than you were, than you are, and you had an associate sitting at the table, and you asked the associate to tell you the bottom line on all the cases here, but you never read the cases yourself, would you say that you hadn't used the cases?
I would say I used them indirectly, but I hadn't had knowledge of the contents.
Well, now, wait a minute. That's an interesting question. Why can't they impose upon you the obligation to have knowledge of the contents of the credit report?
Because now they're adding a requirement to the term use. They're not saying you've used it, but you must have knowledge of the contents and find out about the columns.
You've used it in the sense that Judge Garland just put it to you, because you got the quote from the finance company, then you passed it on to the consumer, and you added a factor for your own cost. So you clearly, it seems to me, used it in that sense. So, you know, that's an interesting point. You got the quote, and then you added to it your markup. So didn't you use it in that sense?
I don't think so, because we don't know whether, in this context, we don't know whether, in fact, the finance company pulled the credit report. We don't know what aspect of the credit report was done. We have no idea what part of the credit report was used, if any.
You don't have to show the actual credit report. All you have to give the consumer, is the essence of it, which you can easily get at from the finance company when they give you the quote.
Well, it's not clear from the record that it's easy or cost-free. And in addition,
you haven't made an argument that it's somehow difficult.
Yes, we have, Your Honor, and the letter says that. But furthermore, and I'm out of my time.
One of the things puzzles me is why in the district court there is a summary, there is an evidentiary question. The district judge is in the business of reviewing agency action. There shouldn't be a factual trial in the district court.
There was a motion to dismiss and a summary judgment, and the judge treated them as cross motions.
One of the arguments you make is that certain factual matters weren't developed in the district court. They're not supposed to be developed in the district court. The district court is sitting as an appellate court reviewing agency action.
You concede that the purpose of the statute works against you. Your argument relies on your sense of the plain meaning of use. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct. And I see that I'm out of my time. If I could just, I'm sorry, Judge Carlin, you were asking
No, I was going to say, maybe you want to say, we'll give you some time for rebuttal, but if you want to say something quickly now, I'll go right ahead.
Yes, I want to answer Judge Griffith's question.
Of course.
I agree that under their theory, the purpose of the statute works against us, but I think the plain language controls. And as the Dimension case says, and I was going to get to that quote to end with, if the act falls short of providing safeguards desirable or necessary to protect the public interest, that's a problem for Congress and not for the board or the courts to decide. And if a rationale for a rule sweeps in consumers and creditors as their causal-based transaction does.
But of course, if we disagree with you, I mean, one of the rules of statutory construction is to look to the purpose, right, to fill in if there's some ambiguity about it.
If there's ambiguity, I don't concede there's ambiguity. But furthermore, if there is, what Freeman said at the end of the day was, if you have a rule that sweeps in consumers and creditors under the same rationale, that is a palpable overreach by the agency and cannot be sustained. And I'd like to say whatever time I have left for rebuttal. Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Good morning. My name is Mame Wissimensa from Pong from the Department of Justice. I represent the Federal Trade Commission. With me at council table are Drake Cotini, also of the Department of Justice, and David Zarotsky of the Federal Trade Commission. May it please the Court, we respectfully request that this Court affirm the decision of the District Court and uphold the FTC's interpretation of its risk-based pricing notice rule. Because the FTC's interpretation of its rule is reasonable, is consistent with the statutory language, and fulfills the purpose of the statute to provide notice to consumers when their credit report or credit score is used in setting the material terms of credit less favorable than that offered to the substantial proportion of consumers. Because the FTC's interpretation of its rule is entitled to Chevron deference, the only—
Well, no, it's Seminole Rock deference.
Excuse me?
It's Seminole Rock deference, counsel. It's even better.
Yes, it's a very highly deferential standard.
Do you understand what I mean by Seminole Rock?
Yes.
Chevron deals with the agency's interpretation of a statute. Seminole Rock, which has been reiterated by the Supreme Court in subsequent cases, with maybe one justice upset by it, provides that an agency's interpretation of its own rule is entitled, if anything, to greater deference than would be true of its interpretation of a statute.
Agreed. And
I don't know why you didn't cite Seminole Rock.
Well, we did cite to Barnhart, which makes this a similar—
That's a fair
principle.
Point. Barnhart doesn't turn cite to Seminole Rock, as I recall, so okay. But that's, you know, that's a sort of a key administrative law point.
Agreed.
Other than Professor Manning at Harvard, everybody else agrees that an agency's interpretation of its regulations is entitled to greater deference than even its interpretation of the statute.
We agree, and for that reason, especially given the highly deferential standard of review, given that this interpretation is reasonable, we believe that it should be upheld. In fact, the NADA's interpretation cannot be reconciled with the FTC's, the actual rule that is at issue here, because it clearly states that the initial creditor is the one that offers the disclosure.
I agree. I have to ask a question, though, about the problem that you face. You say you couldn't have imposed— There's no question that the finance company uses on the credit report, too. There's no question about that. You've never argued about that. You agree?
Well, the finance company uses the credit report,
right, but
the
finance— Right, there's an exemption for the finance
right.
company.
If I may clarify, though, the finance company is not the one that is setting the material terms of credit offered to the consumer.
No, I understand your point.
Right. Okay.
But still, you wouldn't disagree that the finance company uses the credit report.
They do use the credit report.
Yeah, no, the FTC has never argued anywhere else. They've exempted the finance company. And they exempted it because, for one reason, if they hit the finance company, you could theoretically have four different notices going to the consumer because the dealer might have gone to four different finance companies to get a quote, right? And that would be confusing to the consumer.
Correct. That is a reason for not applying another
interpretation. I understand, but just as this may be not directly relevant to the case, but it was raised, but why couldn't the FTC simply impose the obligation on the finance company whose finance is accepted in the deal? So it wouldn't have been a proliferation.
Right. It's possible that the FTC could have done that. Again, as I mentioned, it's not that finance company.
They're just favoring finance companies over automobile dealers who are less popular.
No, because the finance—
Banks are being preferred.
Not quite. The finance company is not the one that is setting the terms for the consumer. So that's the first point. And
well,
secondly—
Well, yes, they are. I mean, they're giving their— Oh, okay, you're right. They give their quote, and then the dealer, of course, adds in markup.
Right, and it's that rate, the rate that's offered to the consumer, which is what is used as the basis for—
I understand. So that's a policy call. You think the dealer has the direct face-to-face with the consumer, therefore it should be imposed on the dealer. But I understand that argument, and I think you make it. But the other argument, though, of the proliferation, if you go to the finance companies, is one that could have easily been handled by imposing the obligation only on the finance company whose quote is eventually accepted.
Right. I would just say that the proliferation argument still doesn't deal with the fact that the finance company is not the one that is offering the rate and the statute.
I understand.
Right.
It was just that argument that the FTC made in their brief, which I thought was fallacious.
Well, certainly they could have found another way of doing this, but as you indicated.
You're right. That's a policy call, but since you raised it in the brief, I had to challenge.
Okay. Thank you. There are a number of reasons why the FTC's interpretation is reasonable. Not only is it consistent with the statutory language, which even NADA concedes that use can have an indirect meaning, but it was within the FTC's purview to determine how best to effectuate the purposes of the regulation. As has already been stated, one of the things that the FTC considered was how many notices should be provided to the user, and that one notice was preferable to multiple notices. In addition,
well, that's just the point we just discussed.
Right, exactly.
That could have been avoided easily.
It could have been avoided, but
I mean, even if you put the obligation on the banks.
Right, but part of what the FTC had to consider in determining how to interpret the rule was the ease of administration, and it considered a number of things, pros and cons of various approaches, and this was the approach that it determined. And even if there is another approach that might have worked, because this approach was reasonable, this approach should be upheld.
It's a different argument, but a good one.
In addition, to the extent that the NADA argues that the prior rule was based upon an inaccurate assumption. Clearly, that does not change what is at issue here, because the rule is what it is, and it was promulgated properly, and this is the FTC's interpretation of its own rule. And in fact, to the extent that the NADA argues that some of the considerations at issue with respect to this new interpretation were not at issue with respect to the rule, that is not true. At the time of the rule, the NADA made it clear that their concern was that the auto dealer is not engaged in underwriting, and therefore, because it's not engaged in underwriting, it cannot use the credit report. However, that's essentially the same argument that they're making here.
You make the point in your brief that the plaintiffs in this case, petitioners, did not challenge the rule.
Yes. And the underlying issue, which is whether having not undertaken underwriting, whether you can have been said to have used the information in the credit report or the credit score, still stands. Finally,
did you agree with Judge Garland's paint example?
I did.
Okay, good.
We have another example if you'd like to hear it.
Another color, because it's
okay.
Won't
it's
help
not
me.
A paint example. Another way of looking at it is if I build a house for you, and I ask him, and I build it out of concrete, and I ask him for the concrete. The concrete contains cement, and you ask me, did you use cement to build the house? And I say no. That it obviously is not the normal use of the term use. And what the FTC set out clearly in its interpretation is that the credit report, the credit information, the credit score is incorporated into the wholesale rate that the finance source provides to the dealer. It's baked into that. And so for the auto dealer to claim that it has not used the credit report or the credit score is just inaccurate. So finally, just to address the NADA's arbitrary and capricious argument, that's a very, very deferential standard of review. It's clear that the FTC fully considered the reasons set forth by the NADA and all of the relevant factors, and reasonably explained the basis for its decision. And so for that reason, it's not arbitrary and capricious and should be upheld. So if there's nothing further.
No. Thank you.
And I would respectfully ask that this court affirm the decision of the district court. Thank you.
Do plaintiffs have additional time? Okay, you can have it back. I don't want her to be upset.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to begin by answering two questions. So when I didn't answer Judge Silberman's question earlier, perhaps as clearly as I should have. So let me see if I can address 640. 640.1, the regulation, you say we didn't challenge. The reason we didn't challenge is that 640.1 applies only to any person that uses a consumer credit report. If we don't use it, it doesn't apply. It doesn't apply at 640.6. And 640.1, as you recall, was done when the word use was still the same in the statute. There was no uses directly or indirectly. So I don't think that 640.1 gets triggered. If you never use it, if you're the initial creditor but you've never used it, you don't trigger 640.1. So there was no need to challenge the statute itself, it didn't apply. So I apologize.
Regulation.
The regulation, yes. And I apologize if I wasn't as clear as I should have been in answering your question earlier. I want to talk about your Seminole Rock and Barnhart issue a minute, just a minute, Your Honor. Barnhart said that the reason you get deference in certain instances is because even if you don't...
Deference on what?
Deference on something short of a regulation. Meade and Barnhart said, well, you don't have to have an Administrative Procedure Act.
Wait a minute. We're talking about apples and oranges. Meade deals with the question of whether an agency gets deference with respect to interpretation of the statute by a less formal method than a rule, substantive rule, or an adjudication.
Correct.
Seminole Rock deals with the question of whether an agency gets deference with respect to an interpretation of its regulation.
Right. And Barnhart talks about the deference that you give to that agency's...
That's against interpretation of the statute, not the regulation. Barnhart is dealing with interpretation of the statute.
If the regulation is clear and uses a term that's unambiguous, then an interpretation of it can't change the regulation itself, and I don't think you get the Seminole Rock deference in that case, Your Honor.
Well, that all depends on your theory that use has an unambiguous meaning.
Well, if you look at the regulation 640.1, it says a consumer report, if you use it in connection with an application for or an extension of credit, a consumer, under their theory, has used the credit report because they've put the application process in rolling down the road.
But even if that were true, they could easily exempt the consumer.
But they haven't. And therefore, their rationale and their theory and their interpretation.
Well, but after all, that would turn the statute on its head. Because if the consumer has an obligation to get the credit report, how the devil is the consumer going to do it? I mean, that's a reductio ad absurdum, I think.
Well, but no, that's exactly the rationale that Freeman used, which says that if the agency's interpretation is one that sweeps the consumer and the creditor in the same bucket, even if they don't intend to do that, if that's what it does, then it's palpable overreach and we don't even reach whether it's a Chevron deference issue. I don't think that the word use in the statute in H or the use in 640.1 is ambiguous. I think it's in the common parlance. And Judge Garland, you talked about painting and they talked about concrete. I'm not going to go to either of those examples because I think the term use in terms of physicality has a different meaning than use in terms of a document. I don't think that
your view is you have to have the document and physically and use it, right?
No, Your Honor. That is not correct. I don't think you have to physically do it. If you know the credit score, you've used it. If you know the credit agency that it came from, you've used it, even if you don't physically possess it. But if you don't know the credit score, if you don't know the agency,
enough
if you don't
know
the date.
Know that the financing company is going to be using the document, even if you don't know exactly how they use it?
I don't think so.
Why not?
I don't think that's sufficient use.
I see. So let me ask this. This has been puzzling me. Imagine that you're a car dealer, and next door there's an accounting firm that among other things, helps banks and other people evaluate credit. It doesn't do any financing itself. And you say, you're the car dealer, and I come in for a car loan, and you say, well, go over to the accounting firm and, you know, give them your information. The accounting firm then uses the credit, the consumer report, and you, the car dealer, says, the only thing I want to know is what rate should I charge? You don't ask for anything else. I don't want to see any papers. I don't want to know how you do it. I just want you to tell me what rate I should charge. Under those circumstances, does anybody have to provide the consumer report to the purchaser?
The accountant would, except for the exemption in 640.6.
Well, no, leave out the exemption for the moment. The accountant doesn't do anything. He's not extending credit in any way. He's just providing a service of evaluating for the...
If there is no credit extension, the statute doesn't reach it.
Yeah. So in that circumstance, car dealers could avoid producing it at all by simply paying another company to give them a bottom line.
Under that rationale, that's outside the scope of the statute.
And you don't think that you're using the credit report by getting the information, the bottom line information?
No, I don't think under the common parlance you are. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, we'll take the question under submission. Thank you.